This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. My co-host Anthony Brooks has been off this week. And what a week it's been. Three more people arrested in connection with the marathon bombings. They were charged with obstruction of justice for allegedly removing a backpack full of fireworks from Jahar Tsarnaev's dorm room. Their lawyers say they're innocent. Here's attorney Robert Stahl.
Mr. Khadribayev and his family are very sorry for what happened here in Boston, and he did not have anything to do with it.
Speaking to CNN through an interpreter, Murat Khadribayev, the father of one of the Kajak students arrested in Boston, explained why his son's license plate reads Terrorista Number 1.
This was a gift from their Spanish friends, it turns out. It's an unusual gag, a joke, which is at the moment being turned into something dramatic.
Also, in the special election for the United States Senate, we now have two nominees, Congressman Edward Markey and Cohasset private equity investor Gabriel Gomez. At his primary night victory party, Republican Gomez played up his youth, casting his mind back to 1976.
Me? I was just playing Little League Baseball. And that was when Ed Markey first got elected to Congress.
Whereas Democratic nominee Edward Markey took aim at Gomez's refusal to support an assault weapons ban and on his stance regarding abortion.
Gabriel Gomez says that he is not pro-choice. I am pro-choice.
Well, those are some of the stories we will look deep into this week with our Week in Review team. We'll also take a look at an update in the mayor's race for the city of Boston. Joining us now to do that is Peter Canellos, editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. Peter, good to have you back.
Thanks, Meghna.
Also with us is WBUR's own Bruce Gellerman. Bruce, good to see you here.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so let's start off with the latest news on the investigation into the marathon bombings. We've heard today that the initial target for the brothers Tsarnaev might have been the celebrations on the 4th of July. That's allegedly what Jahar Tsarnaev has been telling investigators. They say that the marathon was, quote, a target of opportunity because the bombs that the brothers made came together more quickly than they anticipated. So that's news from late this week. Meanwhile, an attorney for Kajak national Dias Khadribayev said that his client turned over Jahar Tsarnaev's laptop to the FBI. His father, Murat Khadribayev, spoke to CNN last night and said that his son, who has been arrested along with three other people, was the younger Tsarnaev, Jahar Tsarnaev's roommate, but that he said he's not implicated in the bombings.
In connection with the arrest of Tsarnaev, since my son was friends with Tsarnaev on their student campus, I mean their halls of residence, they also initially came under suspicion, but within 12 hours they released them, since they weren't implicated in these events. But the next day, the immigration police detained them for violating their visas. The violation was related to the fact that he missed a couple or maybe several classes.
Okay, so just to remind people, Dias Khadribayev is one of three men who were arrested and charged this week with obstruction of justice in relation to the marathon bombings. Now, Bruce, you were in federal court for their arraignment. What did you see?
I saw three very scared kids. They were wearing T-shirts, sneakers, jeans, and they were really terrified. Their hands were handcuffed after they were charged. They had been shackled before, and they were let out. And there'll be a trial. There'll be a hearing on Monday for one of them, the American, Robel Philippos from Cambridge. There'll be a bail hearing for him on Monday, and the other will get a bail hearing on the 14th of May.
Mm. Now, Peter Canellos, so this case, it just took a very strange twist in my mind because these three young men are charged with obstruction of justice for allegedly removing a backpack from Jahar Tsarnaev's UMass Dartmouth dorm room that had emptied fireworks in them, plus the laptop, which they later disposed of in a garbage bag that ended up in a New Bedford dump. I mean, what do you make of what we're seeing in federal court regarding the charges against these three young men?
Well, clearly the three young men made terrible judgments and deserve to face some sort of punishment for this, significant punishment. But this is more significant as just sort of another data point in the emerging picture of the Tsarnaevs and how this plot came into being. And it shows, in a sense, just how haphazard it was, that they didn't have any real exit strategy. They didn't have any plan for getting rid of the evidence. It was literally just one kid calling on a cell phone or tweeting a roommate and saying, get rid of my backpack. And there's something a little chilling about that, just because it feels like such a familiar act. But it certainly confirms that, you know, this was not a 9/11 style, you know, planned within an inch of its life with dry runs and things like that kind of an attack.
And Peter, on that point, actually, I mean, chilling, I think, is the exact word that has come to my mind over the course of the week, because in part because it does seem so continuously haphazard, and yet they were successful. And now also we hear that, Jihar Tsarnaev is allegedly telling investigators that the original target was the 4th of July celebration on the Esplanade that draws hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah, I mean, all of these things are very, very upsetting for Bostonians to read, both because all of these reference points are so familiar to people. The Esplanade, the Marathon, you know, everybody knows New Bedford and the harbor and all that kind of thing. And it's just very, very, very chilling to realize that these things are happening under people's noses or as part of the same community and society that we're all part of on an everyday basis.
Bruce, your
thoughts? I think I agree totally with Peter that it's so chilling is because it's so ordinary. These kids are so ordinary. And when they found Johar on the boat, they found his UMass ID. I mean, this kid wasn't covering up, you know, who he was. He wasn't even making an attempt. And they knew, the FBI knew right away. And yet it took them, they went to the UMass campus. They had been there on the 19th. They had been there on the 21st. It took them the 21st to get a search warrant for the dorm room. And then they find other things. They've already been to the dorm room, presumably, because they spoke to some people there. At that point, and this is in the criminal complaint, they found more pyrotechnics. They found a white cap and a black jacket, which matches up to suspect number two. Mm.
And Bruce, tell us a little bit more about what you know or we know about the third young man who was also arrested and arraigned this week, Robel Filipos, who's an American originally from Cambridge.
He's American from Cambridge. His mother's from Somalia. He was born here. But what's interesting is that he lives right next on Memorial Drive in Cambridge, right next to the two gas stations. And a question that I had was, if they were trying to escape and they had taken this SUV and then went to Watertown, got money in Watertown, then started looking for a gas station, almost got to Waltham, and then came all the way back. They stopped, dropped off a car, one of the cars, a Honda, in Watertown, but then they came all the way back to this gas station right next to Robel Filipos. It's a big unknown in my mind, and I'm wondering if were they going to go see, you know, Johar's friend? I don't know.
Yeah, and we won't know until we get any sort of confirmation from federal authorities. Peter, another question for you. There are some people who are saying that even though these three young men are not implicated or not being charged with anything directly in relation to the bombing itself and only for obstruction of justice after the fact, you know, because two of them were foreign students originally from Kazakhstan, one of them may have violated his student visa. This one has once again sort of torn open that question of, you know, are student visas, are international students sort of a weak link in terms of the web of surveillance or means by which, investigators have to look at these complicated cases?
Well, I think that, you know, this case would provide evidence for what you're talking about. If this guy had been, like, sent by a terrorist organization to have a student visa and come in and become part of this plot, but there's absolutely no suggestion that that happened. They, you know, these guys were, you know, very ancillary characters, frankly, in this bombing plot. But to the extent that they represent, you know, bad judgment and criminality, it's a very sort of discreet, you know, thing. It's not, you know, in other words, it's not a sign that terrorist organizations are taking advantage of these visas in any way.
Do you have a sense as to, because of the fact that Jihar Tsarnaev is allegedly saying that, you know, they built the bombs faster than they thought they would, and their original target was the 4th of July, and that is yet to come. I mean, July is only a couple of months away. Do you have any guess as to whether are we going to see security changes on the Esplanade?
Well, there certainly should be. I mean, everybody should learn from the previous attack. And the kind of thing that we learned from the Marathon bombings is that probably the dog sniffing for bombs was an effective deterrent, because the Tsarnaevs waited until after that had happened, then came in with their backpacks and put them down. So obviously you want to sweep for bombs, but you probably don't want to allow people to come in with unchecked backpacks. So I would anticipate much more security at the Esplanade on the 4th of July.
Bruce?
There is a tantalizing piece of information. Actually, it's a footnote in the criminal complaint where it says that Johar was having dinner with the two Kazakh students, his friends, and he told them a month before the bombing that he knew how to make a bomb.
So maybe the thing there is those kind of statements aren't throwaways at all.
They're not throwaways. You know, it was all out there. It was a bunch of 19-year-old kids talking. And it was, again, it's so banal. It's so ordinary.
Hmm. Well, let's move on to something else that maybe not banal, but has become strikingly ordinary in Massachusetts. And that has to do with elections, because we seem to be in a continuous election cycle. And this one has to do with the latest Senate special election. Primary day in that race was this week, and we now have two nominees. Edward Markey, the congressman, is the nominee on the Democratic side. Gabriel Gomez is now the nominee on the Republican side. Now, there has been some polling this week about that head-to-head matchup. The public policy polling firm, usually Democratic-leaning, says that Markey beats Gomez by a 44-to-40-point margin. Okay, so that's just in the first few days after this primary. There are still 8 weeks to go. Let's hear what Edward Markey himself said this week. He wasted no time lashing into his GOP opponent, Gabriel Gomez. Here he is outlining what he sees as the differences between the two men.
Gabriel Gomez says that he is not pro-choice. I am pro-choice. Gabriel Gomez says that he does not believe that there should be a ban on assault weapons, that he does not believe that there should be a ban on these magazines with so many bullets on them attached to an assault weapon that they really only belong on the battlefields of the world but not on the streets of the United States. Well, I believe that we should be banning assault weapons.
And here's Gabriel Gomez, who in his primary night victory speech on Tuesday said, in fact, he believes he's the man who can reach across the aisle and come to bipartisan solutions.
If you're looking for someone who will put principle before politics and who thinks our country is better than its politics, come join my team.
All right, Peter, let's start with you. I actually think this is one of the more interesting outcomes of the primary that we could have expected. What do you think of the Markey-Gomez matchup?
Well, it's potentially interesting, but those sound bites got me a little depressed.
On.
I mean, it's like there's an air of staleness that needs to be fleshed out of this race very, very quickly. And, I mean, a lot of the focus will be on Gabriel Gomez and who he is. And certainly his persona is very powerful. But whether he can turn that into, a real sense of energy and purpose for his campaign remains a question. Likewise with Markey, you know, the record is impressive, but his presentation has been so lackluster that, he really has to step it up a notch and show that, you know, he really wants to be senator and he has an idea of what he wants to do and that his legislative ability is really going to pay off for people. And we just have to wait for that to happen. It's not happened yet.
Bruce?
Yeah, no, I think Markey's going to make his pass pay off for him. He's very powerful as a representative. He's got a long, he's been there for, 18 terms. But those become the negatives for Gomez in his charges. What he's going to say is this guy is going to make it a referenda on term limits. This guy's been there too long. It's a low regard for Congress. He's a member of Congress. He's going to paint him with that brush. That's what I think is going to happen here. And you're already seeing it. You know, you talk about mudslinging. Gomez is charging him, Markey with mudslinging. He says he's not agreeing to three debates. That kind of thing. You know, his slogan is make change happen, right? Our country is better than its politics. So this is not about Markey. This is about politics, a referenda on American politics.
Well, similarly, Peter, I mean, Edward Markey is going to be painting Gabriel Gomez as, even though as much as he wants to say he's an independent, he's still on the Republican side of the ticket. So it's a referendum on whether or not Massachusetts wants to send a Republican to the Senate.
Well, I think that that's very poll-driven. You know, it's following a script that seemed to work last year for Elizabeth Warren. But Markey would do well to remember that Elizabeth Warren did emphasize all the time the sort of partisan differences between the two of them and that she was more, sort of consistent with Massachusetts voters on every, you know, litmus test issue. But she also offered some new stuff. You know, she came in and said she was going to hold big banks accountable. She had a, you know, theory about the financial collapse, that she was going to make a difference in people's lives. She really emphasized fighting for the middle class. You know, these were different wrinkles that I think made people feel like they could optimistically vote for her. Markey hasn't offered any of those things beyond saying, by the way, I'm more pro-choice than he is, and I'm more against assault weapons than he is, and I'm the better Democrat, and so you should vote for me. And he's got to turn it up a notch.
And Bruce, what do you think about the fact that one thing that Edward Markey is pushing against Gabriel Gomez is the fact that Gomez has said explicitly he won't sign the so-called People's Pledge to keep outside money out of this race?
And he's not probably going to, because he's going to have to spend a lot of money to run ads. They've got a very short fuse on the election. It's next month. So they're going to have to spend a lot of money very quickly. But, you know, is that an issue? Is that what the crisis that's facing the country? You know, is that politics? Is it what? You know, what does it matter? What's interesting is the poll that's just out. Have you seen that? It just came out today that shows that Markey's ahead by only 4 percentage points. And what's interesting, I think, about that is that Markey's negatives are so high. He's favored by 44, but he's unfavored by 41%, where Gomez is about 40% and his unfavorables are 27%. So what Gomez is going to do is go after Markey's negatives.
Okay.
This is going to be a very, very negative campaign.
Peter, last question to you about exactly that point that Bruce is making. So part of the reason I presume that Edward Markey might have a lot of negatives is because he has a long record. Is there any possible way for Ed Markey to reach back to that record and actually spin it as a positive?
Well, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Ed Markey's record is incredibly impressive. He's really one of the top congressmen in the U.S. Congress. There's nothing in that record that he should be apologizing for whatsoever. It's just that, you know, Gomez is a new face and is dynamic and is wanting to create a sense of him embodying the future and Markey embodying the past, and that's a very powerful kind of thing. But Markey should easily be able to refute that by pointing to all that he has delivered for the state of Massachusetts and all that he could deliver as a senior senator, you know, or a senator with a lot of experience coming in and real legislative expertise. So I think that's really important. Another thing I wanted to mention on the People's Pledge, you know, maybe as an act of punditry, maybe Gomez will be successful in sort of muddying the waters by saying, oh, yeah, you know, Ed Markey's taken a lot of special interest money. And I know some people are kind of saying, oh, well, you know, this People's Pledge may not be all that it's cracked up to be. But it's a terrible thing for Massachusetts if the People's Pledge goes by the wayside, because it'll create a messy, ugly free-for-all with special interest groups intruding themselves in ways that neither candidate will really want them to in the long run. And Gomez should sign it, and I would certainly hope that it would become an issue against Gomez, his refusal to sign it, because there's no good reason for him not to.
It will become an issue as long as Markey's campaign chooses to remain or chooses to keep making it an issue, I'd presume. So.
Well, right. And Markey's going to have no trouble raising money. I mean, Michelle Obama's coming in at the end of the month for, you know, $30,000 a plate dinner.
Well, let's.
But Gomez won't have any trouble. I mean, the National Republicans will not let Gabriel Gomez go undefended. I mean, you know, he should have an easy time raising money also. So this idea that somehow it's going to leave Markey with a big advantage, I think, is a little false.
Well, and especially since, as Bruce pointed out, this first poll out this week actually has them only at a 4-point spread. So that might even give the national GOP that much more of fuel to get into this race.
Oh, absolutely. They're not going to miss a chance to support Gomez.
Well, let's talk for just briefly, if we can, about another race. And that, of course, is the mayor's race for the city of Boston. There are 24 candidates so far. And this week we saw the entrance of the first African-American female candidate, Charlotte Golar Richie, former aide to Governor Deval Patrick. Peter, briefly, what do you think her entry into the race does? Does it shake things up? Does it make it more exciting? Or do we just still have to wade our way through these first 24 in the preliminary vote that will eventually come?
Well, it's definitely, the field is a long way from solidifying, let's say. But she is one of the candidates who you can envision winning. I mean, she does have a long resume. In fact, her potential backing from Menino, whom she also worked for, is probably more significant than Deval Patrick. And she had also been a state representative. So she's got a lot of experience behind her. And they're, you know, out of the 24, there are relatively few minorities, and I think only two black candidates. So she'll... she'll have a real chance to build support.
Bruce?
Yeah, no, I got to tell you, I'm prejudiced against her, perhaps, or in a positive way. She was born in Brooklyn, New York. But, you know, here we have a chance to put either a woman into the office. We have a chance to put a Latino in the office. We have a chance to be the first Jewish mayor in the office. This is a historic campaign. I mean, 24 candidates. We've got a lot to choose from. We may have to put them on baseball cards to keep track of them all.
I think you just came up with a great new business model. Boston Mayor baseball cards. Trademarked here. Right now. Radio Boston.
I will say one thing, Meghna, though. The fact that we're already in May and there's still 24 people and no one can even begin to name who all the candidates are is a bad sign, because we're going to be in the summer months when a lot of people will be kind of checking out. And the chance in a very chaotic field like this one for the right person, you know, the person who has what it takes to sort of show their stuff is quickly, you know, passing us by. Yeah. Time is passing us by. And the chances that this result will be more of a kind of surprise, quirky thing rather than somebody really showing the right stuff to be mayor is increasing.
Okay. Well, Peter, I have to say I always appreciate how you bring us back down to reality when I risk floating away. But on that note, I would like to end with some hubbubs for this week. Bruce, let's start with you. What's your hubbub?
BBB. Take a bite out of Boston. They're going to have a fundraiser. The 100 chefs, they're going to gather at Fenway in the middle of May, and they're going to have a fundraiser, $200 a person, and it's money's going to One Fund Boston.
Yeah, it's going to the One Fund. Terrific. Mm-hmm. And with the weather being what it is, these outdoor festivals, I welcome them all after this winter. Peter, your hubbub.
I wanted to praise the city of Cambridge and Cambridge City Council for its sort of far-sighted plans for Kendall Square, where they're going to allow higher buildings than they normally would, which will, I think, only increase the vibrancy of the area. But they've also set aside space for innovation and for startups. So they'll maintain the fundamental character of Kendall Square as a hub of innovation, where people don't need a lot of money. They just need a lot of brain power. And I think it's a great plan. Cambridge is going to benefit from it, and the whole area is going to benefit from it.
Yeah, I think that the whole area could benefit by also maybe considering opening up that idea of having taller buildings than we've had before, even in Boston, per se.
Yeah, I agree with that, too.
So my hubbub actually takes us out to Northampton, because there is a children's book author and illustrator there named Jarrett Krajoka. And Jared, if you're listening, I apologize profoundly if I've mispronounced your last name. But he has a popular series of graphic novels called Lunch Lady, which was inspired by the lunch lady at his school. And in these graphic novels, she is a superhero who fights crime with spatulas and other kitchen gadgets, saying serving justice and serving lunch. The Lunch Lady character has been optioned by Universal Pictures for a live-action film starring Amy Poehler as the Lunch Lady. So I actually think that I'm really looking forward to seeing Amy Poehler serve justice with a spatula. On that note, Peter Canellos, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe, always great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Meghna.
And WBUR's Bruce Gellerman, great to see you at the Week in Review. Thank you as well.
Go Celtics.
And listeners, stick with us, because when we come back, we'll take a visit to Copley Square and talk with Bostonians and people from around the country who've come to visit the memorial that sprung up there. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.